I mean, of course, there's one narrative if you see from the central level, but there's another narrative if you see from the ground up. And the ground up, you see much more iterative, creative, innovative, multi-actor oriented approach that you can't see from the top. And I think that is really the strength of Bangladesh. And the challenge is, how do we harness that?
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Bangladesh has witnessed a remarkable turnaround in recent decades. From being termed as a basket case by the American Undersecretary of Political Affairs in 1971, it is now frequently talked of as a development success, having achieved fast economic growth and considerable poverty reduction. While Bangladesh's per capita GDP was the 10th lowest in the world upon independence in 1971, by 2015 the country had reached lower middle income status. Indeed, over the past decade, Bangladesh has been one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It has, among others, benefited from a demographic dividend, strong ready-made garment exports, and stable macroeconomic conditions. While literacy rates have soared, infant mortality has plunged. And Bangladesh is now on track to graduate from the UN's least developed countries list in 2026. To discuss what has worked in Bangladesh, including the role of the state and civil society organizations, I'm joined by Imran Mateen, the director of the BRAC Institute of Governance and Development in Dhaka. Imran has worked extensively on poverty reduction, financial inclusion, governance, health, and social protection. He also serves as country director of the International Growth Center in Bangladesh. Imran and I discussed the Bangladesh model of development, the influential role of the NGO, Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, otherwise known as BRAC, in the country's development record, and innovative poverty reduction programs that have been implemented in the country in recent decades. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Imran, it's been many years since I last saw you. I'm so delighted that we have a chance to speak today. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
So Imran, one of the fascinating things about Bangladesh these days is that there has been this extremely, I would say there's been some sort of a pendulum shift from nothing working, being considered to be, you know, one of the poorest in the world. The narrative now is about how Bangladesh is really a development success story. And just earlier this morning, I saw a short sort of a video snippet compiled by the World Economic Forum, and they were highlighting how the Bangladesh model has really relied on this fast economic growth, special economic zones, millions have been lifted out of poverty. And it, of course, has helped the country that it has the world's biggest garment industry, but also a large and very young workforce that is in a position to harness digital power, digital technology. The tech industry is growing. There's a lot of emphasis on knowledge creation. So let me begin by asking you, Imran, do you share this narrative? Do you share this positive vibe on Bangladesh that has been created? And if so, what explains this relative success that Bangladesh has experienced in recent years?
Thank you. Yeah, no, I definitely share that excitement and that exciting narrative of Bangladesh. I mean, especially if one takes that historical starting point into consideration, I think, you know, there's a lot to celebrate and a lot to be excited about. But I think, you know, what is perhaps still we don't fully understand is, you know, how exactly it has, you know, things have come together. And I think that is actually what has happened. I think many things have come together in ways that have not been necessarily planned. And I think that is fundamentally important for policymaking and for the approach to policymaking and the approach to, you know, things that have worked in Bangladesh, which is an iterative approach, an approach of learning and testing, piloting, and not really doing grandstanding on grand ideas. So I think Bangladesh is in many ways a story of iterative, small incremental changes, not necessarily all planned out together. It's a bit Hirschmanian in many ways, I think. So I think that's the way I, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, I like to think about how things have worked until now. And one of the challenge, I think, for the future is, how do we then take this to the next level? How do we take this much more of a Hirschmanian iterative approach to even policymaking, you know, checking out what is working and then sort of improving on it, that whole approach? How do we take that to more complex challenges that we currently face without losing that ability of agility and also multi-actor oriented approach to addressing our challenges, right? And I think that's exactly where the kind of politics, the kind of governance, the kind of development approach we basically need is something that sometimes I worry about and I'm a bit concerned about. And yet, time and time we see that is exactly what has worked in Bangladesh. If you look at even the COVID governance and the way in which, you know, where Bangladesh has managed sort of COVID. I mean, of course, there's one narrative if you see from the central level, but there's another narrative if you see from the ground up. And the ground up, you see much more iterative, creative, innovative, multi-actor oriented approach that you can't see from the top. And I think that is really the strength of Bangladesh. And the challenge is, how do we harness that?
That is also my understanding, my limited understanding of Bangladesh, having visited it many years ago. What I think is fascinating about the Bangladesh story is that, unlike some other countries that were perhaps at similar stages of development that were extremely dependent on aid from the outside, where perhaps even today policymaking is characterized by heavy top-down processes, Bangladesh, as you say, has in many ways perfected this bottom-up approach. You have all these experiments and building on local knowledge, and we'll return to the role that various development actors, including BRAC, has played. I was intrigued by what you said just now, that all of this is happening, of course, in a very challenging and polarized political environment. And if there's one thing that I associate with Bangladesh, not so much in recent years as much as, say, a few years ago, it is this constant political turmoil and strikes and change of governments and violence. How has this local knowledge been able to shape development policy with all of these actors involved and with a political leadership that seems to be, or the political situation that seems to be fluid at most times? How is this possible given, as you just said, some of the major governance challenges that existed and continue to exist today?
Yeah, so I think, you know, my friend Naomi Hussein has, you know, kind of really looked into this question. I think I really like, you know, what her line on this is, or her thinking on this is, which is that in Bangladesh, there has been some, you know, kind of solid compacts, I think, between politics, the bureaucracy, and the civil society, and also the private sector. And I think, you know, some of this compact has sort of centered around some very essential problems. So, you know, essential problem of service delivery, essential problem of food security, or, you know, preventing famine, which affects everyone. That compact has really delivered, right? Because, you know, despite the political, you know, kind of uncertainty and turmoil and all of that stuff, it is this compact, consensus on this compact, without really being explicit about it, there has been an implicit type of a, you know, kind of a agreement, consensus that, you know, we cannot have famine again. And if you look at COVID management again, it comes so strongly you know, food supply and agriculture sector has been the most important sector for everyone to really, really focus on and sort of protect. Ensuring kind of the food distribution system works relatively smoothly during this time, prioritizing that as the most essential sector, you know, it sort of came back again, despite the sort of fluidity and the uncertainty that you sort of referred to. So I think it's this consensus around some real points of jeopardy. And I think that still exists, but I think that may be wearing off. And that is the kind of challenge. So what is the next sense of big jeopardy that we can really build that implicit consensus around to be able to, you know, ensure that we are notching up the country outside the so-called, you know, middle income or, you know, trap that we may be basically getting into. So what is that jeopardy? What is that sense of jeopardy that we can really build ourselves around? And it really needs to be that sense of jeopardy. Famine really, really worked, really helped us, you know, in terms of creating that sense of jeopardy and coming together between bureaucracy, the politics, the civil society, and the private sector. So I think that has been, I think, a quite powerful glue.
So in this story, Imran, BRAC, your organization, has been an extremely important development actor, as I understand, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, which is considered to be the world's largest non-governmental organization. It was founded in 72, and I don't have the latest figures, but apparently around 100,000 employees or 90,000. It has been widely praised. There have been books written about BRAC. The Economist termed it one of the world's most successful NGOs, that it was actually successful because it was commercially minded. A lot of people say BRAC does what the government should be doing. And in many ways, because of all these activities that BRAC does in terms of, say, microfinance, providing internet, it has a university that you're a part of, schools, you know, mills and chicken farms, tea plantations. I don't know. It's a long list of things that this organization does. Some would say that it is actually almost more powerful than the Bangladeshi state. So tell our listeners a bit, Imran, about BRAC. I mean, this hugely successful NGO, what really has worked for BRAC? How did it become such an important part of the development landscape in Bangladesh?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, two things. So I'm right now with BRAC University, but yeah, I obviously part of the BRAC ecosystem. I've worked for many years with BRAC, so yes, I can definitely reflect on that. But right now, I'm not part of BRAC the NGO. I'm part of the university, but I think I definitely, yeah, you know, would like to reflect on your question. So I think, you know, BRAC in many ways, you know, is you know, not in many ways, I think is sort of fundamentally, I think studying BRAC would help us understand Bangladesh, and understanding Bangladesh would help us understand BRAC in many ways. So, you know, BRAC was formed, you know, was very much part of the history of the creation of Bangladesh, right? 1971, you know, our founder, Sir Fazli Hasan Abed, was deeply involved, you know, even before 1971 with the, you know, the 1970 cyclone, which was a watershed moment in terms of the, you know, the kind of, you know, galvanizing the, you know, the sort of creation of Bangladesh politically. Our founder was very much, you know, involved with the relief effort and, you know, in Bhola during that time, and then was very much involved with 1971 movement from UK, and then, you know, sold his house, and just after the War of Independence went back to Bangladesh and formed BRAC. So there is that, the 1971 ethos, you know, the ethos of creating a nation building and you know, citizens being part of nation building in that very active way, I think was very much part, I mean, that was very much part of the 1971 ethos. 1971 was fought by an alliance of, you know, middle-class intelligentsia and peasants, and fought in the villages of Bangladesh, in village to village. You know, that's where, you know, this you know, village by village, so it was a guerrilla warfare. So I think that ethos of active citizenry, I think was very much embedded in the formation of BRAC and the idea of BRAC. And that's exactly why when people, I remember this Heart Talk interview of our founder where Sir Fazli Hasan Abid was asked, you know, that exactly, you know, you are doing so much and so many. I mean, how, what gives you, you know, this right in some ways to think about how to reform governance in Bangladesh, you know, because, you know, there was a program that, you know, my institute has been running on training civil servants. And his response is, you know, I am a citizen of Bangladesh. And I think that idea that, you know, as citizens of Bangladesh, where we've got so many problems and so many things that are not working, and the creation of Bangladesh was through that ethos that simple people, common people can do amazing things. And I think it is this ethos that is at the heart of BRAC, right? But again, the part of that same ethos is that it is not through a kind of grand plan. It is through everyday practice and struggle. You know, it is through that navigation of a guerrilla warfare. You know, that is how you basically create something big. And I think that is the other part of the BRAC ethos.
Well, Imran, I would think that when one becomes as powerful, as influential as BRAC has become, this is not always politically acceptable, that there may be political actors that perceive this, rightly or wrongly, as a threat, right? So how did that work out in Bangladesh? How was BRAC able to maneuver through this very difficult political terrain?
That, I think, is one of the, you know, the kind of most, you know, most important maneuvers that BRAC has been able to do very successfully, and not much has been written about or worked, you know, kind of thought of. I mean, I think that's been primarily by ensuring that, you know, again, BRAC has been always very, very clear about the work it does, about, you know, why it exists and the work it does, and, you know, and keeping people, really poor people, poor woman at really the center of its work. And as long as anyone is contributing to that, BRAC has always lent a helping hand, irrespective of any partisan political, you know, kind of. So it's been really very focused on that and steered away from any ideology, any kind of ideological kind of approach to its work. I mean, of course, there's been a wider ideology and wider politics, but we're talking about small I, and, you know, kind of, I think small p. So that BRAC has been really, really careful. So it has worked, you know, all across all political parties, spoken to across all political parties, as long as the cause was very, very clear in terms of keeping poor people really at the heart and center. And I think, you know, kind of that focus really helped. The focus on service delivery really helped. Mm-hmm. So BRAC always spoke the language of service delivery, never spoke the language of rights that much, spoke always the language of service delivery. Even rights, BRAC spoke in the form of service delivery, right? So yes, there are rights, but then services need to be delivered to ensure people are able to, you know, fulfill those rights, even if it's human rights. You know, people need to be educated, people need to learn about their rights. So it took a very service delivery oriented approach. And I think that also really, really helped.
Often NGOs are perceived to be helping people, making citizens aware of their rights and helping them claim these rights.
Right.
And that is what political parties often detest, you know, having created more demanding exactly. citizens, these NGOs are stirring up trouble.
Exactly. So I think the approach that BRAC took, again, from a service delivery point of view, but kept it very clear that change will have to be driven by people themselves. And we are just facilitators and very distant facilitators, active but distant. BRAC really kept that line very, very clear, right? And did not really, you know, try and create any kind of, you know, if BRAC's, you know, village organization members, you know, BRAC was quite active in terms of in ensuring that whenever there was an opening, say, of the local government, woman representation, BRAC played a role in terms of ensuring that, you know, more women from its village organizations who, you know, could actually get elected. But, you know, it was always invited spaces, right? So BRAC was much more, I think, much more interested in taking advantage of invited spaces and keeping the claim space part to be driven by the people themselves as much as possible, and keeping a very sort of a distance from that space claiming agenda. So I think that could be a critique as well, but I think that's what has helped BRAC in terms of ensuring that invited spaces are effective.
One of the many things that BRAC has done really well is also paying attention to research, as I understand it, and continuous learning than many other NGOs. And this is where I suppose the university has played a role. I'd like to hear your views on this aspect of continuous learning that David Cotton, who wrote this book, When Corporations Rule the World, he called BRAC as a near to a pure example of a learning organization,
That's right.
Is likely to find. So how does this work in practice? I mean, what is the relationship between, say, BRAC University and the NGO? Are there evaluations? Is that, how does continuous learning actually work in practice?
So I think continuous learning is sort of much more than sort of having formal research. I think it's certainly a very important part of it, but continuous learning is much more about a culture within the organization. And you know, when I was at BRAC, and I sort of started off my career at BRAC as in the research and evaluation division of BRAC, which was set up in 1975. You know, BRAC was formed in 1972, and even when BRAC was so small, tiny, working in a cluster of villages, BRAC thought that it should have its own research and evaluation division. You know, our founder was extremely clear that, you know, we need to be driven by evidence, and both tacit knowledge, but also formal and structured knowledge, both have to come together, you know, to be able to actually design and continuously improve. So not only formal knowledge, you also need very strong tacit knowledge. So, you know, each and every BRAC program meetings at the field level are you know, fascinating, forum for learning and discussion and challenges. You know, that has always been a culture in BRAC. So tacit learning and more structured formal learning, combining these two has been really central. And you can see that right from the beginning of BRAC. And Research and Evaluation Division was an in-house independent unit, you know, supporting BRAC's programs through, you know, structured and systematic research and evaluation using cutting-edge research methods from 1975 until 2019. In 2019, BRAC, our founder, you know, this is one of the last decisions he made, that he basically decided that the research and evaluation function of BRAC should now be transitioned into the university. And because the BRAC University, you know, by 2019 was sort of quite established, and he thought, you know, that would be the right time to make this transition. And there are three institutes of BRAC University, which are autonomous entities within BRAC University. So, you know, I lead one, BRAC Institute of Governance and Development. There's a BRAC Institute of Education Development, and there is a James P. Grant School of Public Health. So these three institutes have absorbed, or the research function have been integrated across these three institutes with the idea of providing more independent and higher quality research and evaluation support to BRAC's program. So now we are at the kind of, if you like, this phase two of providing, you know, research evaluation support to BRAC, you know, where independence and quality have been kind of stepped up even further. I mean, the challenge, of course, is that while doing this, what about the you know, the kind of action research, the more rapid, that whole culture of learning that is you know, one could argue is requires a level of interdependence and that closeness and proximity, which how are we going to ensure that now that this is now part of Brack University? So that is really the struggle. And this is where I think we need to, you know, put our heads together and sort of figure out how that is not lost. And then we can really notch it up notch up the whole knowledge agenda and the learning culture within Brack to a whole different level.
Evaluation departments are typically in most aid agencies, you know, given this independence, right? So they can criticize and be open-minded and raise uncomfortable questions. Now, since you were involved with this as early as the 70s, Imran, what were the lessons learned then and how have things changed now? I'm thinking about this motto that Brack has had, building resources across communities, you know, and you are trying to, as much as Brack, the NGO, was running an NGO, but there was also a business side of it. There was this focus on really seriously taking the social context of poverty. And we've already discussed, of course, how Brack was able to maneuver through the political landscape. How was it possible, Imran, in the early years to combine the NGO side of Brack with the business side of Brack, which has often been highlighted as a very unique and successful model?
Well, I think I mean, our founder obviously came from the business world. He was the CFO of
Shell,
Of Shell in Pakistan. So he obviously, you know, came from a very strong business background, but I think he had very strong developmental roots in his upbringing. So I think for him there was never a kind of he was very clear about how these things actually, you know, kind of the synergy between these two, taking a business, so one is taking a business like approach to doing development, and even when you're doing, you know, kind of, you know, more grant based type of work, how do you take a much more of a business like approach? And that's something that I think right from the beginning, when Brack was formed in 1972, one of the first grant Brack got from Oxfam. We're doing a project right now called Historicizing Brack, where we're trying to, you know, locate the history of Brack, you know, within the broader global development history, you know, and we're looking at historical documents. I mean, you know, one of the things that impressed everyone about Brack right at the beginning was this kind of business-like approach to relief activity. You know, the accountability, you know, then ensuring every penny is accounted for, you know, value for money, results-oriented. That whole approach was fresh compared, you know, in that time period. So I think that business-like approach has always been extremely, extremely, extremely important for Brack. But getting into business for Brack was also, you know, was basically seen, look, I mean, there are areas, there are problems for which you need a more grant-based approach and non-market. Markets don't really work there. As a matter of fact, markets are terrible. And markets are not the best, thing for that. For instance, essential healthcare, essential education, you know, these are not where, the extreme poverty. But there are problems where you know, markets can be made to work better. So, you know, now there's whole talk about making markets work for the poor. I mean, Brack was building markets for the poor in the sort of starting from the 70s. If you start looking at, you know, how Brack got into poultry or livestock, each of these are about market development. And as Brack approached a market development problem, Brack never approached it, oh, we're going to have a feed mill, we're going to have seed processing facilities. All emerge out of that iterative approach to the problem. And looking at the supply chain and looking at, okay, where the constraints are there other actors who can actually play a role, or does Brack need to play a role here to be able to, address the particular challenge or, you know, constraint that we currently have. And then over time, Brack has actually exited from certain market segments. Poultry, you know, Brack right now is not in the poultry sector anymore. It was one of the largest sector Brack was throughout the, you know, 80s and 90s and up until 2000. So now Brack has exited. So, you know, Brack enters to really create the market, in many ways crowding private sector. Once that that basic market infrastructure, especially in the sort of the lower end, is sort of created, some kind of market standards are also created, and then BRAC does exit from some of those sectors as well. So that's, I think, so for BRAC, kind of getting into the market segment has been very natural, because that's, poverty exists both in market and non-market spheres, right? So, you cannot basically, have the luxury, especially in context of, a weak private sector and sometimes, weak public sector, to only address one particular segment of the problem.
We've spoken a bit about how BRAC was able to move into certain sectors and move out, like you mentioned, the poultry business. Were these decisions based on impact assessments and evaluations? I'm trying to understand the role that knowledge and knowledge creation, constant evaluation has on such an influential NGO. Were these so-called independent assessments, were they asking difficult questions that other arms of the organization were able to respond to?
Yeah, so I think a good example of that, I mean, for the poultry sector, this obviously was based on, sectoral analysis and, market analysis and all of that stuff. And the research division, and that's been one of the challenges also, I think the research division was basically set up to focus much more on sort of impact on sort of poverty and, women's empowerment and health and education related issue. Not so much. I don't think there's the strength of BRAC's research. And I think it's something that I think would be really important to, and I think especially in the current context, to really kind of think about and improve, is the private sector part of not only BRAC's work, but I think overall Bangladesh's development work. I think BRAC has a big role to play, especially in terms of making markets work for the poor. But that whole dimension has not, BRAC's internal research hasn't really focused on that part as much as it has on, impact of microfinance or education or health and so on and so, and so things like that. But I think this is a natural, kind of progression, especially, in the sort of current context as well. But your question about the role of research and sort of in terms of program development and, asking difficult questions, I think one great example there is BRAC's Ultra Poor program. I think the Ultra Poor graduation program of BRAC, I think, really benefited from, long-standing sort of diversified research engagement and research, studies that have been done on the program. And then, it sort of obviously led to, a lot of global interest, and, there have been global replications of some of these models, and, subsequent very rigorous studies have been sort of conducted. And all of those sort of studies did lend a lot of credence and to the program itself. But I think in terms of its adaptations of the program over time, I think the research function has also played a very important role. For instance, the Ultra Poor graduation program started off as a pure grant-based program, right? It was just a full grant, pure grant. I think, again, it's very difficult to say, whether, how much of it is because of research, work, and how much of it is because of program's own knowledge and tacit understanding, in terms of what's really happening on the ground. It's a combination of the two. But I think in 2012-13, it was very clear that the underlying context of extreme poverty was rapidly changing in Bangladesh. Markets were working, much more effectively, especially there was a lot of local economic buoyancy that was basically, kind of happening, but yes, despite that, the extreme poverty was still there, but the nature of the extreme poverty is very different. And unlocking this, doesn't have to be only grant-based. I mean, we can actually have a more mixed approach of grant and, some cost recovery. And maybe we need higher value of asset transfer that we were doing compared to before, which would, and to make it sustainable, we need a mixed approach. And I think that was, it sounds very simple, but, that required a lot of, lot of structured formal knowledge, combining with program's own understanding what was really happening on the ground, that led to then redesign of the program. And we have done further evaluation, and we found the mixed model to be extremely effective. As a matter of fact, in terms of cost benefit, way more promising than only the grant-based approach. So that's sort of one. The other example in the Ultrapoor graduation program is that the program initially started off with focusing on, the extreme poor. But within the extreme poor, there were obviously a lot of heterogeneity. It was trying to address, kind of different categories. But I think, we sort of realized later that, the Ultrapoor graduation program primarily is a graduation program. So it's a livelihood program. So there are certain type of demographic characteristics we need to pay more attention to. So for instance, if it's a female-headed household, with no, adult income, other adult income earner for that household, actually this type of, livelihood, graduation program isn't approached really the most appropriate one. We need to think about them differently, and maybe think about integrating them to other social safety net services that exist, old age allowance and others with the sort of government. So I think those type of, sharpening the thinking in terms of, how do we, design the program and, segregate it. I think that's where research and evaluation, kind of works much more effectively. I think that's the case for, kind of even high level, research and evidence, to influence policy. I mean, if policymakers do not want something, I do not think research evidence changes their mind. Research and evidence role is to, what is it that what is it that you really think works? And then, kind of figuring out iterations of that and sort of, smaller improvements in that. And I think that is a reality. And I think, people in the world of research evidence who want to, who are interested in policy influence need to get a bit humble and sort of realize that, yes, I mean, of course, you can have all criticality in your academic papers and get published. But if you really want to, influence policy, the contribution is really at the margin.
Let's talk about the poverty reduction aspect, Imran. So in many developing countries, in many low-income country contexts, we have chronic poverty, and then there is, of course, extreme poverty. And countries like China, having grown their economies enormously in recent decades, it's just earlier this year that it formally announced the eradication of extreme poverty. If you were to think about the Bangladesh example, the Bangladeshi experience, how was that started? So the typical problems, of course, in any poverty reduction program is identifying, targeting, getting the money for innovative policy programs, making sure there's no leakage. What was it that worked in Bangladesh in terms of what you call the ultra poor program? How did that start? Was it a focus on cash transfers? Was it on jobs? Was it on service delivery? And what was the plan in terms of graduation from that extreme poverty into, let's say, a chronic poverty and then out of poverty phase?
I think the starting motivation was very much that existing market and development oriented interventions were leaving behind a large number of poor people who were not being able to benefit from the existing growth and development sort of processes. So I think that was really the kind of starting point, and what you need, and there's a trap here. So we say it very easily right now, but I think there's a whole conceptual difference. If you think, whether you think about this group of people who are being left behind as being entrapped or not being entrapped, because if they're entrapped, then you need a big push. Because incremental interventions are not going to work. If you think they are not in trap, you know, incremental interventions, you know, could work. You know, you have more longer term programs, but incremental and all that stuff. If you think it's a trap, you have a, you know, you can have a time bound intervention, a big push, and you know, kind of forward linkages, you know, with market and development, you know, services, and you know, hopefully things that things can get better. And I think you know, evidence has you know, I think there's been quite really good, you know, kind of rigorous evidence that we have collected and modeled in partnership with London School of Economics, where, you know, we can and really show that, you know, extreme poverty is a trap. And, you know, that's we need basically a big push strategy there. So I think that's the kind of first motivation. I think it's a really important one, because that has implication for your design of social protection programs, right? Because if extreme poverty is a trap, then you should be thinking more about, you know, the big push part. So and then the idea that with this big push, actually, you don't need long term for a large majority, you don't need the long term social assistance. Of course, there would be circumstances, you know, and group of people for whom you would need long term social assistance. But the sensible thing to do is to sort of have that big push, which would be more resource intensive, and over longer run, midterm, free up resources from there, then to be able to invest much more on your, you know, longer term social assistance. But the political bargain here is, of course, you know, kind of, you know, quite sort of difficult. And, you know, that's ongoing, I think. I think policy, education and policy discussion, you know, that sort of needs to basically happen. But in terms of, you know, sort of after the, so what are they graduating to? I think that's sort of you know, the whole idea here is that you know, it's sort of financial inclusion is critical, you know, for the next and after this big push part for that to really, you know, kind of help in, you know, creating the next level of sustainability, if you like. So financial inclusion is critical, and not only kind of credit, but also, you know, longer term, you know, savings and risk-reducing instruments are really, really important there. We're increasingly seeing education, of course, education and skills. So in thinking about this graduation intergenerationally is really critical. And I think, you know, this is going to be the next, you know, the next big design, you know, kind of frontier challenge that we need to really work on is how do we think about graduation and design the graduation, you know, kind of model and approach as an intergenerational one. And that would require a lot of service level integration with the sort of broader ecosystem of services, you know, and sort of markets, you know, kind of participation that we need to basically design. And of course, you know, you're going to have different touch points of that. So it's not going to be a one-point graduation. One needs to think about multi-point graduation, but how do you do it without creating a huge, big program, you know, integrating everything, but how do you actually do that in a smart way to think about, you know, multiple points of intervention, of maybe information and, you know, kind of connecting next generation with different types of services, skills, you know, career advice and things like that to be able to, you know, get to the sort of next generation or sort of graduation happening. Because I think this, the graduation problem cannot only be solved in one generation, with the one generation approach and a single point in time approach.
So when we think about poverty reduction in Bangladesh and millions being so-called lifted out of poverty, are we mainly thinking about the extreme poor, people living in extreme poverty now having graduated into more chronic poverty? Or are we also thinking about people living in chronic poverty having moved out of poverty altogether?
Yeah, so I mean, our evidence suggests about 3/4 of people sustainably move out of $1.9 PPP. So I think that's the evidence we basically have, and this basically happens with a combination of, you know, the kind of obviously, you know, the sort of asset transfer and the occupational transformation. So both things need to happen. So, you know, the asset transfer need to be, you know, of a substantive, you know, kind of, so the bigness of the push is sort of important. And then, of course, the occupational transformation from casual labor to self-employment, you usually, you know, we're talking about women's labor, household-based, you know, employment is often the occupational transformation. But the next transformation we need is, and that will most likely happen intergenerationally, is the transformation to decent work, you know, decent wage work, right? Good jobs. We basically need that transformation to happen for it to be really kind of, you know, kind of, you know, move to the next level, if you like. And that cannot be only a household level, you know, thinking. We need to be thinking, you know, more broadly about markets and sort of about different points in the graduation pathway, you know, for the next generation. Right. So I think next generation focus is going to be really, really critical. And it's, you know, what is really interesting is, you know, given our current, you know, kind of, you know, education, you know, quality and all that stuff, this is my hypothesis that for poverty, you can most likely you have a poverty trap at the really bottom of the pyramid, if you like, and for the extreme poor, you know, at the sort of bottom 10%, maybe you have got, you know, you basically have that poverty trap. But if one thinks about an educational trap, I think that educational trap would cut across much wider socioeconomic group. So, you know, maybe the richest would be able to, you know, be out of that educational trap, but large number of sort of socioeconomic groups are within that you know, because of the educational system and the quality around it, you know, and the deteriorating quality around it, you basically have education trap affecting a large number of sort of you know, people, poor and sort of non-poor as well. So just graduation out of poverty is not going to help getting out of the education trap. That requires other interventions. Right. And I think that's what we need to basically think about. I mean, how do we give those interventions, you know, which are effective, but at the same time, we're not going to be running another education program. Right. So this is really about what are those marginal interventions that can really make that difference.
There are many things, of course, Bangladesh is known for and associated with in terms of development. The two things that come to mind for me, and for I'm sure a lot of my listeners, one associates microfinance with Bangladesh, you know, in terms of innovative poverty reduction programs. And of course, both BRAC and the other major actor, a non-state actor, Grameen, has been involved. And I'd like to hear your views on how the BRAC model of microfinance differs, say, from Grameen. Then another set of questions, or another question, would be related to what you just said about decent work, because Bangladesh is also associated with this hugely successful large garment industry. And one thinks about some of the more recent scandals, you know, Rana Plaza and fires, and one thinks about all these major clothing chains that are shamed because they're not providing the right kind of wages and working conditions. Have these been improving? So two issues, one on microfinance, between the differences between BRAC and Grameen, and the other one on decent work and recent improvements in legislation and practice on decent work.
I think the biggest difference, you know, between sort of BRAC and Grameen approach is, you know, Grameen, you know, it sort of focuses much more on, you know, just the financial service. And I think, you know, the assumption, I think, in many ways is that, you know, once access to financial service, you know, on its own would kind of improve things, or, you know, create conditions or create demand, you know, for people to, you know, kind of make other changes. So I think it's a more microfinance driven kind of approach, whereas in case of BRAC, it has been not so much microfinance plus, I mean, that's what people say, but I like to think of it as microfinance multiplied. And that basically means that it's sort of constantly thinking about very smartly leveraging both microfinance as a financial service. So, you know, of course, when access to finance itself, you know, how do you leverage that, you know, by other complementary interventions like health, education, or market development, training, and so on and so forth. So that's the plus part. But the other very important part is that how do you also use the microfinance, the social platform of microfinance? And I think this has become, you know, kind of maybe less important right now, but I think microfinance has, you know, to deliver microfinance, you need to create this social platforms, you know, groups, and, you know, village organizations and networks. So how do you use this, you know, these social platforms for that you have to create to deliver microfinance? How do you use these platforms to do more, to sort of leverage these further, these networks and these platforms, to provide other services and create other types of changes, right? So I think that is where the multiplied part is, and I think that's where BRAC has been really, really creative. And if you look at, you know, different interventions of BRAC, be it health or education or even market development, it's not only the access to finance bit that has been used, but also the platform of microfinance, the kind of organizing platform of microfinance, which is poor people's, you know, organization. It's not a registered organization, but this is poor people coming together to sort of get access to a service. And this platform, how do you use this platform then? And I think a lot more can be done on this, even if you may not have the physical platform as much as important, you know, as it was in the past, because, you know, now, you know, people know microfinance, so the need of that kind of a platform building may, the social platform, physical platform building may be less. People are also very busy and they don't have time to basically come and spend time. But how do you use, you know, kind of digital platform then, you know, to basically create that kind of a networking effect to get poor people to, you know, access higher levels of, you know, market access and market linkages and also social problems as well. And I think that is really a very powerful feature of sort of, I think, microfinance generally in Bangladesh, but I think BRAC has been particularly focused in terms of harnessing that power. So I think that's the, you know, that's the difference. I mean, you know, very early on, you know, BRAC never, you know, when BRAC started Rural Credit Program in the 80s, BRAC used to call it RCTP, Rural Credit and Training Program. For BRAC, it was always about credit and training together, right? So it was, you know, both the skills part need to be improved, the market development and the skills part, along with providing access to credit. So unless you do both of this together, you know, it's just not going to, you know, have the desired effect, right? So I think that's that many way distinguishes. In terms of RMG, I think there's been, obviously, because tragedies happened, there was a lot of accord and alliance, and there've been a lot of donor-driven, if you like, or a buyer-driven, you know, kind of compliance effort that's been basically put in, which is not there anymore. I don't think that that is the best way to improve compliance, because...
Which way do you mean, in terms of legislation?
In terms of a buyer-mandated approach, I mean, that's what the Accord and Alliance, this is just after the Rana Plaza, these are, you know, two, you know, kind of high-powered bodies were basically, you know, set up. And, you know, this was like, this really shot up the cost for many RMG sectors, because the prices are obviously, you know, in the sort of value chain wasn't increasing, but the compliance level was basically, you know, kind of requirement was increasing to be able to do business. And so especially for smaller players, I mean, of course, they were not part of the Accord Alliance. But I don't think, you know, that has really kind of led to a sustainable change in the sort of overall kind of standards. And I think that would have to be driven, you know, kind of on the one hand, it needs to be, you know, the sort of the regulations need to be much more, how should I say, much more customized to the contextual realities of where we are in terms of our our, you know, sector. So, for instance, building code, right? I mean, you know, you cannot import building code, you know, requirements, you know, from Europe and then, you know, basically try and impose it in the sort of Bangladesh context, you know, and that's just not going to be very, very, you know, sort of effective. So this would require, you know, more creative, you know, again, incremental, creative, experimental approaches here in terms of, you know, what is the minimum that we basically need. And we need a consensus around that. I mean, the sad part is that, of course, our associations, such as the Employers Association, Factory Associations, the BGMEA, and others are not, don't really have a lot of teeth with respect to their members. It's the members who drive the sort of association, rather than the association having much teeth. So I think that is really the kind of sort of challenge. I think the possibility here is that there may be, you know, kind of good practice that may be emerging out of clusters within the industry. So maybe it's not all the members of BGMEA, but maybe there are for their own interest, from a self-interest point of view, they may be bigger actors for whom it may make sense to really take on a much more of a standard setting leadership role that makes sense for Bangladesh. And I think those type of possibilities in terms of new clusters that may be sort of forming, one is to understand that and figure out how to sort of enable that and help that to create, you know, kind of that kind of pressure to set standards that may work for us.
So the whole world is, of course, now, well, large parts of the world are talking about climate disruption. And if there's one country that is exposed to some of the most serious challenges that is caused by climate change is, of course, Bangladesh, low-lying areas, cyclones and floods and enormous destruction that disrupts the lives of millions of people almost every year. What, according to you, Imran, is the current discourse on climate change in Bangladesh? Do you see considerable political mobilization to undertake certain measures for adaptation? What is the current climate on the climate in Bangladesh?
Clearly, I mean, Bangladesh is on the, you know, on the side where, you know, we are really, you know, the kind of bearing the brunt of big climate human actions that have been happening, you know, around the world, especially in the West. And so, you know, that context is there. I'm not, you know, that the climate justice context and, you know, the kind of resource flow that would be required from a damage and, you know, loss and damage point of view. That's sort of one part. In terms of, I think Bangladesh can, you know, it's already, I think there's this lot more happening in terms of the climate adaptation area than I think we sort of know. So I think that there's a lot more work that needs to be done in terms of how to, you know, what are the constraints that people face in terms of adopting or the uptake challenge of, you know, climate smart solutions. You know, is there a problem with the design of the solution, or are there other constraints that we need to address? Where does the constraint lie? Is it the individual level or the collective level? And what kind of policies can really help unlock that? And I think that is a very active agenda in sort of Bangladesh. And I think that's where I think Bangladesh, again, can come up with real social innovations in terms of, you know, community-driven, community-based models of climate smart, you know, solution, in increasing the uptake of climate smart solutions in sort of agriculture, in energy, and sort of areas like that. So I think that's where, you know, Bangladesh can really come up with, amazing social innovations. But the other part is climate migration, and I think, and especially how do we plan our cities? How do we empower our kind of cities and city authorities and city governments better? And I think this is where another, you know, kind of conversation, and this could be opening of a different kind of a city government and governance discussion that needs to basically happen, because, you know, it's not Dhaka really. Dhaka is, of course, but there are other secondary cities around in near the coastal belt who are actually bearing the largest brunt of this, you know, climate migration that's basically happening, and it's happening in a very quiet way. One of the challenges that, you know, I think that, you know, we still are focused on, you know, obviously the big events and then the big upsurge that basically happened, but not the quiet, silent, everyday, you know, kind of erosion of livelihoods that is basically happening and the effects of that. both in the source and the migration that is basically kind of happening there. So I think that is another area that needs huge sort of focus. And sort of finally, of course, I think also the sort of transition, what is now being in the literature called as just transition, right? So all of these, climate solutions would sort of require the winners and losers. There are transitions. There are, different stakeholders. So how do you basically get the just transition happening? I think that's another big area or big constraint in terms of being able to make progress in some of those community-based adaptations that would be really necessary.
Imran, I really enjoyed chatting with you today. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.